All right.
So I'm just going to start asking you questions, and you can, they're often going to be pretty general, and so you can kind of, I can be more specific if it would be helpful, but I'm kind of just interested to see, you know, what stories you have and the ones that you want to tell.
Okay. Or maybe when you begin, Jane, I should warn you that I'm not the world's best speaker. I think a lot better when I'm writing than when I'm just speaking,
yeah.
Which is sort of surprising after all my training as a lawyer and years in the courtroom.
Mm-hmm.
But I still find that kind of difficult. And I also thought, this morning I woke up and I thought, why did I get into this, knowing that I wasn't a particularly good extemporaneous speaker? And I guess it's the way I've lived my life. Somebody says, would this interest you? And I think, oh yeah, I'd love to do that. So here I am. But anyway, I just wanted to warn you about that.
Oh no, I mean, and this can be more of a conversation as well.
Yeah,
as
okay.
I find it hard to not kind of bring out my own experiences.
And, that's fine, I love it.
Personal questions involve my own experience and my own thinking about being a woman in the legal profession today. And so, I mean, it'll be natural. I'm not going to ask for long monologues that are perfectly, you know, it's
okay.
It's
good.
It's a very fluid.
Yeah.
So I will just start with questions about your family. I know you're from Durham, North Carolina.
I grew up in Durham, North Carolina. My father was professor of political science at Duke University. He served on the town council in Durham for many years. My mother was basically a homemaker, although she was a very fine musician and was an organist at several churches in Durham, organist and choir director, and she directed a children's choir at our church. And she was very devoted to the very fine Durham Choral Society that she spent many years singing in. So that's sort of my background. I have one brother who I went to Duke. My brother also went to Duke.
And I remember reading that when you retired, it was to take care of your mother and your brother. Is that?
Yes. My brother was a very popular and very successful lawyer. He had been in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Washington. He had then been with United Airlines in Chicago. Then left all that to come back to a small city in North Carolina and practice law with a law school classmate. And after he'd been there several years, he developed multiple sclerosis and was unable to continue practicing law. And he is now in a nursing home in Durham. The last few years of my mother's life, she was devoted to taking care of him. And they moved into a retirement nursing facility in Durham. And I was spending an awful lot of time driving down there, worrying about them, trying to help them because my mother needed help and my brother obviously needed help. And so when my term expired at court, I decided I should not sign up for a second term, but devote my time to taking care of them. And I think it's a choice I don't regret. I spent several years taking care of them, selling my mother's house, taking care of her estate and her millions of possessions because she was a real pack rat. And after 3 or 4 years, I kind of resumed my own life. So.
So both your brother and you ended up as lawyers. Did you have, was it your family? Was that accidental or?
Oh, Jane, you will laugh at this. My mother would always say to people, she said, oh, it's just terrible. She said, I ended up with two lawyers and I didn't have a single teacher. She was hoping both of us would become educators and teachers. And I just was never drawn to, I just never thought that was something I wanted to do. So I wanted a different kind of career, and I don't know why that was, and apparently my brother felt the same way. And I think at that point, law school, people were very interested in law school, and a lot of people were ending up in law school that weren't real sure what they wanted to do, but thought that law would be a good tool for whatever career goals they would have.
Was that true for you?
Well, that's funny because I always thought I wouldn't be a real lawyer, that I would do something else. And I guess when I thought about practicing law, I thought I would, what I, when I went to law school, I thought what I wanted to do career-wise was to be an in-house counsel to a government agency. Never leave the office, do legal work, work in Washington. And instead, I ended up my whole career being in court. So you sort of just never know how things are going to turn out. So, but that's one reason I went to law school, was thinking it would be a good background to have for any kind of career you wanted. And then I ended up with maybe a slightly different career from what I anticipated.
Backing up, I know you went to Duke University. Can you talk about that process, about going, because I'm very interested in the context of you being a woman who was in many ways a trailblazer in terms of the education you are receiving. A lot of undergraduate colleges, I imagine around the time when you were attending, were not didn't accept men and women. And so I imagine you've often found yourself of a very small minority in a class.
Well, I don't know that that's true, Jane. Duke had a very strong women's college. It's now, after I graduated, it has been more integrated, and it's been totally integrated into the university. But when I was there was a separate campus for women and then a separate campus for men. And we used to think it was an ideal situation because all the women lived together. We ran our own organizations, which gave us a lot of experience in leadership and in developing committees and things that we were interested in, and yet we could have a very active social life and interaction with men in the classroom. So I've always felt that that what I did was not unusual at the time. Duke was, a pretty outstanding school in the South, and they've turned out some very remarkable women from that era. Elizabeth Dole was a year ahead of me at Duke, and we were friends, and she was a great inspiration to me. Ellie Smeal, who was president of NOW, was there when we were there. Judy Woodruff. So there were a lot of capable women being turned out by the Women's College
And
at
you
that time.
yourself were the class president.
I was class president. I ran for president of the Women's College student body, and in the great Robinson string of defeats, I was defeated in that effort, but became president of the class. And I had never been terribly interested in extracurricular things, and then I got to Duke, and I got caught up in a lot of student government organizations and that whole aspect of college life. And I got very involved in that. And I guess that sort of started me on all the community involvement I've had in the years since. So I give Duke either credit or blame for that, for sparking that interest when I was a student there.
And so from Duke, you moved on to DC right after graduation?
From Duke, when after everything I've said about Duke, I will say that the women who went to Duke were very traditional in that at that time in the 1950s, you went to college, you met some guy, and you were married right at the summer after you graduated from college. Well, that didn't happen to me, and all my friends were getting married. And I just was really, I think I was not interested in getting married, and I didn't have a real steady boyfriend at that time. And I really wanted something more. I wanted to go to a big city. I wanted to just try some other things. I guess since I had grown up in Durham and had gone to Duke, I had never had the experience of being away from home, and I'm sure that probably motivated me some too. Although I didn't think about it at the time, I just thought, what am I going to do? I can stay home and hope somebody comes along and marries me, or I can strike out on my own. And so I went to Washington, didn't have a job, went to Washington, interviewed in a lot of different offices, and ended up working as a clerk typist at the Administrative Office of the United States Courts. I had to go down and take the civil service exam, and I think I started out my career as a GS-3, which is as low as you can get in the federal civil service. But I was in a wonderful office. It was located in the Supreme Court building. So I was able to go upstairs from time to time and hear different arguments before the Supreme Court. I didn't really know any of the justices. I knew a lot of the staff members. And I enjoyed working with the administrative office of the courts. There were a lot of lawyers, obviously, working in that office. And one was a young woman lawyer. And she was also a very motivating force in my life because I thought, gee, you know, she became a lawyer. Maybe that's something I could do. And she encouraged me to do that. And all the lawyers in that office said, you know, you really, even if you don't become a lawyer, you should go to law school and take a course in federal jurisdiction so you'll understand more about what our office does. And so I thought, well, that sounds like a good idea. It's the way I've led my life, as I said at the beginning. So I enrolled at Georgetown Law School at night to take a couple of courses. At that time, you didn't have to have LSATs to get into law school. I just went over and signed up, and they said, fine. So that's how my legal career started.
Were your parents supportive of your move to D.C. after college?
Yes, I think they were. Mm-hmm.
And yeah. The whole, you know, I understand the pressure of not being married. Well, I can theoretically understand the pressure. All of my friends are single, so it's I'm not feeling any pressure. But the, you know, having friends around you marrying, and I wonder if that was. I mean, I wish. Can you talk more about that? About your own, you know, decision to not just wait around. I imagine that might have been set you apart from a certain.
Well, I say that because I really believe all my close friends in college were getting married that summer. I was bridesmaid, and I can't tell you how many weddings that summer after graduation. But then, I mean, I was not the only one because I ended up in D.C. rooming with several girls from Duke who had also not gotten married and had come to Washington for various types of careers. So I wasn't the only one. But I just knew in my heart of hearts that I didn't want to sit around waiting for somebody to marry me, that I just wanted to strike out on my own for a while. And the fact that I ended up in law school, I had always thought I would go back maybe and get a PhD in English or history, which had been my interests in college. But that didn't, I wasn't sure I really wanted to do that. And I guess thinking about law, I thought, well, that's an intellectual challenge, but it also maybe would play more into my interest in civic involvement, that type of thing. And so I think that's one reason I was attracted to law also. I can't say I was really attracted to law. I just thought maybe that's how it would work out.
And your work when you were choosing where you were going to be interviewing in D.C., were you looking more specifically at jobs that involved the government in terms of pursuing the civic engagement?
I think what I really wanted to do was to work for a senator or a congressman, and I did interview in several offices. Senator Stennis's daughter had been a classmate and a friend at Duke, and I interviewed in his office, and he offered me a job answering letters from people who had problems with their Social Security. And I wasn't sure I wanted to do that, so I decided not to do that, and I kept interviewing. And right now I can't remember exactly what led me to interview with the administrative office. But the deputy head of that office had been very active on the Hill, and he had worked for Lyndon Johnson, so he was very well connected. And somehow we just kind of hit it off, and so he gave me the job, and it was an interesting experience. In fact, I probably shouldn't tell you this, but the other day I was looking at an old collection of keys I have, and I have a key to the Supreme Court. On this keychain, I'm sure it's been changed in the years since I worked there. But if I had to go in, I mean, there was just no security in those days. So that was my great career at the Supreme Court, but it was fascinating. And I saw a lot of the justices in action. Earl Warren was still Chief Justice. Hugo Black, who was a great hero of mine because he was from the South, was on the bench. Felix Frankfurter, Justice Douglas was on the court. His secretary had grown up in Durham, so she was always very nice to me. So, and the clerk of the Supreme Court and the assistant clerks, they were also, I was kind of the young kid in the building, so they all kind of doted on me, and that was a lot of fun. So,
Can you talk more about your responsibilities in that job? You say you were a secretary.
I did a lot of typing. I kept files for the office and for the Judicial Conference of the United States, which is a group of the chief judges of all the circuit courts of appeals. And they meet and they sort of decide, what kind of things are going to push in the Congress for the federal courts. And they talk about the court rules and other matters like that that affect all the federal courts. And when I was there, I believe John Biggs, who was the chief of the Third Circuit, was head of the Judicial Conference. It turned out he was from Delaware, and since being in Delaware, I've met his son and grandchildren. We always referred to him as Chief Judge John Biggs because when he would call on the telephone, he would call me Big Beautiful Battle. He would say, "Big Beautiful Battle, this is Chief Judge John Biggs." So I remember that. Albert Maris, who was a federal judge in Philadelphia, was also very active in that conference. Jim Browning, who then went on the Ninth Circuit, was the clerk of the Supreme Court at that time. So I met a lot of impressive legal types before I even went to law school. More so then than since, I guess. But so that was an interesting job just out of college.
Did you get a sense of, I mean, you mentioned the Supreme Court during that era. I think it was, it's kind of held up as an activist court for liberal policies. And I wonder how you saw that in terms of, and this is going to be a larger question, but in terms of your own politics and your ideas.
Well, I don't know how much I thought about that at the time. I was, for a Southern gal, I think I was very liberal at the time, and so I probably thought it was great that it was a very liberal court. But I think I was more interested in maybe watching the interaction among the justices at that time. And that was always very interesting because sometimes there would be little spats, while they were on the bench. And I had a great deal of admiration for Earl Warren. I thought he was a very impressive person. I've always been very interested in him, although I've grown much more conservative, and I understand a lot of the objections that conservatives had to his court. But there's no doubt that he was a really strong leader. He would have been a great president of the United States. He just embodied so many wonderful leadership traits, I thought, and a broad background of experience, which I thought was interesting too. And as I said, I had a great deal of admiration for Justice Black because I thought he stood for a lot of things that were not popular in our part of the country at that time. And when I had been at Yale, I took a well, when I went to Yale, I took a course under Charlie Reich, who taught constitutional law, and he had clerked for Justice Black. So I always enjoyed hearing him. He remained in close contact with Justice Black, and so I always enjoyed hearing his tales about Justice Black and his family. And he once told me that I reminded him a lot of Justice Black's wife. I didn't know whether that was a compliment or not. Might have been better to have been compared to Justice Black, right?
I wonder if it's a comment from an era. Perhaps it's the closest he could come to saying.
That's true, yeah. And I remember being, I heard, Griswold versus Connecticut being argued before the Supreme Court, and the woman lawyer, Harriet Pilpel, who was arguing against the state of Connecticut. I can't remember the reproductive rights people who were arguing the case. I remember she wore a great big hat to argue her case in the Supreme Court, which was unusual, but I've always remembered that. In fact, I've been a great believer in people wearing hats, because when I was in high school, I interviewed for an Andrew Duke scholarship at Duke, and the finalists all came to this interview, and there must have been 50 of us there, or I don't know whether there were that many, and one girl was wearing a hat, and she won. So I've always told my daughter, if you're in a group, wear a hat, and people will remember you. So that's one of my hat stories, that and Mrs. Pilpel wearing a great big hat, picture hat kind of thing, when she argued before the Supreme Court.
Have you ever used the tactic?
No, I'm too shy to do that. Another thing in my life, which is sort of along the same lines, and when I ran for lieutenant governor in Delaware, another lost election, but I was on stage a lot, and that year, now Vice President Biden was running for the Senate, and people would just get transfixed by anything he said. It was just, he would stand up, he could have read a grocery list, and people would just be falling on his every word. I couldn't believe it. And of course, I was in the opposite party, running in the opposite party, and I was sitting there on the stage behind this table, and he was just mesmerizing the crowd, and I thought, you know, if I just reached out and turned over this glass of water in front of me and jumped to my feet, I could break this spell. But I was not brave enough to do that. And I've often thought, maybe if I'd done that, the whole course of history would have been changed, right? I doubt it. But anyway, that was another thing that incident from my past.
So you mentioned going to Yale Law School. So this is
I worked in D.C. for maybe 2 years, 59, 60. Yeah, and I went to law school at Georgetown at night. And after a while, I mean, I was exhausted trying to do that. But it was a really interesting experience, because that whole night class was full of people who were really working to get ahead and to get that law degree. A lot of them were married and supporting families, and it was just a different group of students than maybe I met at Yale. And I've always thought that was a very good experience. The way law was taught there was very different from Yale also. It was more you would stand up and recite, and they would call on you, and you would sort of stand up and give the facts of the case, and then kind of have this debate with the professor about the holding in the case and how the court got there. And that was very different from the freer kind of atmosphere at Yale. So I've often thought that was a very good experience, to see both ways in which law is taught. And I don't know which was better. Yale was more fun. Georgetown was a lot scarier.
Why is that?
Just because being called on to stand up and recite in front of all your classmates.
How large was the class?
There could be, you know, my recollection is that there may be as many as 100 in torts and contracts. Some of the other courses were smaller, but I took torts and contracts and legal research. And I guess a lot of other things at Georgetown, they're the ones I remember. And they were very large classes.
And the gender breakdown?
There were maybe, you know, I can't remember, maybe 3 or 4 women among all of those students. So that was kind of scary too.
Did you notice professors treating the women differently than the men in terms of that stand up and recite?
Um, Not particularly. I never, you know, at that point in life and in history, I never thought it had to do with gender stereotypes. I thought it had to do with me. If I felt uncomfortable standing up and speaking in class, it was because of me. It wasn't because I was a woman or there weren't more women around. Now that I look back at it, I think, well, that was really naive. But that's the way I felt at the time. I felt if I felt uncomfortable, it was my problem. And it wasn't the problem of the class or the professor. But I can never recall being treated disrespectfully by a professor. Although, you know, I did notice that the professors were a lot chummier with the male law students. You know, they would pal around with them a little bit more. Some of them even were offered jobs that I don't think were available for the women law students, you know, at the law school. And, of course, Georgetown was a Catholic school, too. That might have made some difference. But now I don't remember any of my professors at Georgetown being condescending at all.
Maybe not condescending, but on the other extreme, gentle or going, treating, just different treatment.
They may have, I don't know, because I made pretty good grades. But then that could be from being treated differently. But I just don't know the answer to that. I'm sorry, but I just don't even. I do remember one time in contracts class, we had a case that involved, and I still can't say it very well, whale oil, a contract for the sale of whale oil. And with my southern accent, the professor in that class had a lot of fun getting me to talk about that whale oil, and he would come back to it during the year every now and then. Maybe Miss Rankin could tell us about whale oil because of my southern accent. So I do remember that, but, you know, I think that was in good fun and not being nasty or condescending.
I bet you learned that case very well.
I learned that case very well, and I've been very careful in the speaking of whale oil ever since. Although I've not had much chance in life to discuss whale oil. But I do remember that. But anyway, I would study whenever I could, and I would just take my leave before I got through the federal government, before exams, and I would just go down to the basement of the house I was living in D.C. and study and just cram for the exams. And after I'd done this for 2 years, I thought, this is stupid. I can't do this for, you know, 2 or 3 more years, the long as it would take me to get a law degree. So I decided I would try to transfer. And I applied at several schools and got accepted, and I got accepted at Yale, which was a big surprise. But there were about 7 people in my class that transferred to Yale. So I learned that was one good way to get into Yale, maybe the easiest way to get into Yale. Just go somewhere else, do well, and transfer. So that's what led me to Yale. So I was at Yale only 2 years from the second and third year.
Was Yale your top choice, or was it the best that you...
Well, I think when I got admitted to Yale, I thought I should do that. I was admitted at Duke also, and I was kind of drawn to go there just to be back down south and near friends and family, but I thought I should go. I should stay away and take the advantage. And I'm glad I did. It was great.
And in all of this, your parents were supportive?
They were always supportive. Yes, they were very supportive. I think my dad was delighted. I think he was very proud of me. My dad was a very interesting person, and he encouraged a lot of minorities and women in their careers. He hired several women professors in the political science department. one of whom, Margaret Ball, came from Wellesley down to Duke, was a very distinguished, I think she taught international law. And he got her to come to Duke, and there were several black professors that he recruited and got to come teach political science at Duke kind of very early in this whole movement. So he was very supportive, and he was always very supportive of me. And I often wonder if it hadn't been for my dad, if I would have done all these things. You know, I do think he was. But after a while, he said, you know, Battle, he said, it's great for you to have a career, but I really think you'd be a lot happier if you got married. So I think he was getting worried that I wouldn't marry and I would just be a career gal. But I did eventually do that. So I do remember my dad saying that. And my mother never worked outside the home, but she was a very smart gal. She had graduated summa cum laude from Duke and Phi Beta Kappa, and she did a lot of things. She wrote several local history books, and she was a very fine musician, as I said earlier. So she encouraged me too, although her example was very different. And it's kind of funny because in some ways I think during my working life, maybe my dad was my model. But since I've retired, I think my mother has been my model in being devoted to my home and my family and to local things and doing these little projects, local history projects and all, very much like what my mother did. So I often wonder what my mother would have accomplished if she had a computer. She didn't even know how to type. She would copyright everything in longhand. And I've often thought maybe in a different age she would have, no telling what she would have accomplished, because she was a very capable woman.
I'm going to just make sure the microphone is close enough. I think these are powerful little microphones, so I'm just going to pull it.
Okay. Do I need to talk more in that direction?
No.
Okay.
It'll pick up everything. So now I'd like to hear about Yale, about, you know, moving to New Haven, about your class. What was your first impression?
Tara. It was scary coming to, well, first of all, I never had any problem with New Haven because I grew up in Durham, North Carolina, which was also kind of an industrial town when I was growing up there. So New Haven seemed very familiar to me. So people would always complain about how terrible New Haven was, but I always felt right at home at New Haven, except that it rained all the time, it seemed to me. And I noticed that because I was living in the graduate women's dormitory and I had to walk back and forth to the law school, and it seemed to me it was perpetually raining, but I'm sure that's not correct. It's just how I remember it. But it was scary and I mean, everybody knew everybody at that point. The class had kind of melded together, as you do going through the first year together. And here I was in this whole, I didn't know any of the students, didn't know any of the professors, hadn't been through that first year with them, had a very different experience. I had also been out working a couple of years. You mentioned that you had done that before you went back to law school, and I thought that gave me a little bit different approach, as I think you mentioned it had for you too, that maybe you weren't quite as caught up in the competitiveness or whatever of the law school, because you realized more about where all this was going. And I had seen other things. I had seen another law school. I had worked with lawyers. So maybe I didn't get caught up in that aspect of the law school as much.
You mentioned, I mean, you were interested in how, when you were working in Washington, you were interested in witnessing how the judges on the Supreme Court interacted with each other. I imagine that also gave you a different perspective with which to attack law school.
Mm-hmm. I think so. I think it very definitely did. And also just being acquainted with some judges probably made a difference. And I guess so. You know, it's really hard for me to remember now what that constitutional law class was like. But no, I think it all did give me a different perspective. Another thing that was interesting was being from the South, and there weren't a lot of Southern students at Yale Law School at that point. There were a couple of us, a few of them. You know, I can think of more and more as I sit here and speak. But people were you were kind of a curiosity because not only were you a woman, but you were a Southern woman. And that seemed to kind of surprise everybody. I mean, I remember people coming up and saying, "What, you're from North Carolina? I know somebody from Georgia." It's like, you know, I'm just out of the zoo or something, and they know somebody in another continent. But anyway, that was kind of unusual.
How did you react to it, or did that affect how you worked at law school or socialized at law school?
Well, I will say that most of my closest friends at law school are also from the South, and a couple from North Carolina. Now that I look back on it, it just, I don't know, it was the thing that you were a bit of a curiosity. And did that affect me? I don't know that it did. You know, I was very, I mean, they were curiosities to me too. I had never been to an Eastern school, had never been in the Ivy League at all, so it was interesting to me to see Yale and see how what students there were like. So I learned from that experience.
Now, you mentioned you lived in there's a women's graduate dorm, and I know that at that era there was also dorms in the law school. Were they only?
They were only male, and the women had to live in Helen Hadley Hall, and I think most of us did. And maybe a few, maybe the last year, got an apartment out somewhere. But I think most of us lived in Helen Hadley, and I lived there for 2 years. And at the time, I complained bitterly because, you know, it was like at night, you were in the library closed, you were tossed out onto the streets of New Haven to walk back through the rain to Helen Hadley Hall. But in some ways, I think that was good too, because I met a lot of women who were in different disciplines. There were women there who were at the medical school studying to be midwives. There were women there in economics and history. And so, in a way, I thought maybe my experience was a little broader than if I had just been in the dorm meeting law students all the time. So, you know, as I said, at the time, I just thought this is terrible. They ought to set aside an entry for the women law students. And I guess they eventually did, that women law students live within the law school, but then we didn't.
And do you have a sense of how many women were in your class?
Yes, there were 12 in my class, which is the most that they'd ever had in a law school class in the history of the world. And it was like Western civilization was threatened by so many of us. But, you know, we carried on. And I think I was accepted because a couple of the women had dropped out after the first year. And so I kind of filled their slots when I transferred. I don't know that, but I always suspected maybe that was. But we had a very, there were a lot of very outstanding women in my class that have done very well. Marion Wright Edelman, Eleanor Holmes Norton, Barbara Babcock, who's taught at Stanford Law. So, you know, there was some great women in that group.
Now, you mentioned that Western civilization was threatened. Did you feel that there was a backlash as to, like, oh my gosh, there are all these women here now?
I felt there was some of that.
From where?
Mostly from the other students, from the male students. But on the other hand, most of them were quite nice and very accepting, and they would invite me to go down to Corby Court because women weren't allowed in. Do they still have Corby Court? That was an eating club for the law school. They had a little building, and they would serve meals there, and the law students belonged to it, but not the women law students. But they would take me along sometime.
Is that like Maury's? We have Maury's.
Yeah, I know Maury's, and I wasn't allowed in Maury's either. And in fact, that's interesting. Fred Rodell, I took his course in legal writing, or writing about the law, which I enjoyed a lot. And that class always used to meet at Maury's. And then when I joined, and I think Jane Noble was in that class with me, and they had two women in the class, and we couldn't meet at Maury's, so we had to meet in the law school. And I think the guys kind of resented that. But that wasn't our fault. That was Maury's fault. Corby Court wasn't wasn't as fancy as Maury's. It was just a little spot. So, I don't know. You know, I was very much caught up in studying and trying to get along, and I didn't focus just a whole lot on discrimination, really. And I just think that was part of the era. If it had been 10 years later, I probably would have felt much more discriminated against. But at that time, it was, as I said, it was like, it was my problem. It wasn't the law school's problem. It was my problem if I had any difficulties. So maybe that was good. I don't know. You know, maybe that made you work harder and overcome things. I don't know.
Living in the women's graduate dorm, was there any talk of that discrimination, or were you all just kind of very focused on your studies?
Well, I guess we would sort of joke about it, you know, in a way. But we didn't organize to demand anything. I don't think that ever occurred to us. You know, we would make comments like, you know, cracks about Maury's or something like that. But it never occurred to us that we should go over there and picket Maury's or anything like that, or demand that the law school not have anything to do with it. And while I was there, this is interesting, while I was in law school was when Yale announced it was going to go co-ed. And I was in a drugstore on the corner there of York Street and whatever that main, Whaley or whatever that main street is. I don't know whether there's still a drugstore there. And it came over the radio, and there were these students in there, and they all started booing that decision. I do remember that. People were very upset about that decision to go co-ed. So I do very vividly remember that and being thinking, well, that's stupid of them. So, but that's true. You know, Yale itself didn't have women students. It was just the law school and the graduate school that had women in it.
So you were a minority all over.
I was a real minority.
And you mentioned that might have made you work harder. Or just thinking that, you know, if there was any different treatment that you received, that it was individual.
I think that's probably what I thought at the time.
Since I don't know, I imagine you've been back to Yale to see the women's table. I walked by.
No, I haven't.
Oh, you haven't?
No.
Oh, well, the women's table. It's a sculpture in right in front of Sterling Memorial Library in the campus, the main Yale campus, and it's called the Women's Table, and it's this big fountain, and it's flat, and the water bubbles out from the middle of it, but in a spiral around it, there are numbers, and it's zeros for a few loops, and the years, every 5 years or so. And that's the number of women that were at Yale in that year. And eventually, I think that they stopped carving into it around 1995, I want to say, when it hit, like, parity, when it was the same number of men and women.
And that's interesting. That's funny, because I don't remember seeing that. I've gone back to a lot of my reunions, but I don't remember seeing that. And the next time I'm there, I'll have to make a point of seeing that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's in cross campus, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I know exactly where cross campus is and where it would be. And maybe I've walked by and didn't realize what it was. But no, It meant that the few of us who were there, I think, were pretty close. You know, we, that's all I can tell you about that.
And you mentioned one of your classmates at Duke started the, or was the president of the National Organization of
Legend of
Women.
Women.
Was there a large women's rights movement at that point, or?
I can't remember that there was any women's rights movement whatsoever. Either I was incredibly stupid and just oblivious to all this and just caught up in my own little personal problems, which is a good chance that was that was the case in my 20s. Or there just wasn't much of a woman's movement at that time. I mean, it was later that she became president of the National Organization for Women. And I can't remember when. You know, it seems to me I was out of law school and in Washington working for the Justice Department when the women's movement sort of began to come into its own. And that the language was added to the Civil Rights Act. Yeah, I was out of law school and in Washington before I really got caught up in that. But, you know, there weren't a whole lot of women going to law school, and so in some ways, the ones of us who had gone to law school, once we got out and were looking for jobs, I think it helped us that there were so few women, because they were looking, actively looking for women to hire. So I think in some ways it was just helpful to the career that I was one of the few women who had a law degree, to be perfectly frank about it. You know, I don't know how I would have done if 50% of the lawyers had been other women. I probably would be home raising kids. I don't know. So, do I remember much about discrimination? I just don't remember much about a lot of discrimination at Yale Law School in those days. I know there were very few women, that we didn't have our own. I'm trying to remember where our restroom was in the law school. We had to go. I mean, it was far, far away and very inadequate, the women's restroom. That was the first thing that impressed me when I went back to Yale for a reunion, was that they now had an elaborate women's restroom, and we were all saying, oh, this is really an improvement over what we remember when we were here. But as far as the way we were treated in class or moot court or anything like that, I don't remember feeling that there was a lot of discrimination. You know, we might have joked about some things, but as I said, we never organized to change things. I always wanted them to change the seats in the classrooms because, and we all wore stockings to class in those days. And I was forever snagging my stockings on the rough chairs. And I spent all sorts of money buying stockings. And I mean, that's just so silly now. And I kept thinking, they've got to do something. They've got to change this because all the women law students are going to go broke. But that's one thing I remember. Was always complaining about that. So, I don't know. But I think on the whole, it was, you know, it was a typical student experience with camaraderie among the students, the males and the females.
You mentioned it was a lot of fun, or at least more fun than Georgetown. I'm wondering how you socialized at law school, where the fun came in.
How did I socialize at the law school? I didn't socialize a lot. I remember sitting down at meals. I remember exchanges at meals. We would go out on dates. I would date some law student, and at that time it was, you know, the males asked the females out on a date, and we would go to a movie or you know, that was, and sometimes there were a few law students who lived off campus, and there were some married couples that lived off campus that we were friendly with, and they would have parties at their house. And I can actually remember cooking a meal in the dorm woman's in Helen Hadley Hall for a guy I was dating. I can't believe I did that now. But that was a good thing we did. I don't think the and I went out with some people I met in New Haven too, some young men I met who were working in New Haven, so I had a little more regular social life in that way, going out to meals or out to parties and all in New Haven. So maybe my experience as a law student was a little broader than some of the other law students.
Do you think that that was beneficial?
I think probably in the long run it was beneficial. I don't know that I would have thought so at the time, but now I think, yeah, that was good. I saw some of the town of New Haven. I met different kinds of people. I met people who were salesmen and bankers and things like that, as well as law students. So that was good.
Did you have a feeling that the male law students or the law students that lived in the law school had a very kind of insular experience?
Well, I think maybe more so than the women did. Yeah, I do. Yeah. We used to, I would go visit friends, guys who were in the dorms, and, we'd hang around there and talk in their rooms before I had to go back to Helen Hadley Hall. So we were part of that social life with the law school. And then the law school, am I crazy? I think the law school actually sponsored some parties. Maybe out in the courtyard, and yeah. I remember doing the twist out in the yard with, when they'd play music and we'd have a dance or they'd have beer or whatever out in the courtyard. And that was part of the social life.
Was the gender balance of those parties very, was it daunting at all if it was only the women of the law school and the men of the law school?
I don't think it was ever just that. I mean, I think. A lot of the guys obviously had girlfriends from other schools, and they would come in for weekends, and they had an active social life. And yeah, I guess it was, there was an imbalance, and I'm sure a lot of the guys didn't come out and participate because they didn't have dates or there, weren't enough gals to go around. But yeah, that's kind of what I remember, although I haven't thought about it for a long, long time.
Is there what sort of classes do you remember? Are there any classes or professors that still kind of stick out in your mind?
I think the professor that I enjoyed the most was Grant Gilmore, and he, excuse me, he was a commer he taught commercial law, and I took his negotiable instruments course, and the thing I remember about that course was he talked about the challenges and the difficulties of codifying the common law, and when you might not want to codify the law, and when you would like to codify the law. And the difficulties with the language you use and the codifications. And that just really intrigued me. I was so interested in that. And then later in my career, I became a member of the Uniform Law Conference of the United States. And what we do is draft legislation. I didn't know it at the time, but part of his experience that he was teaching us came from his association with the Uniform Law Conference and the drafting of the Uniform Commercial Code. And I've thought of his course so much as I've worked on this legislation through the Uniform Law Conference. So he was a tremendous influence on me and one of the best professors I ever had. I thought he was terrific. I also enjoyed Alexander Bickel's course in administrative law. That was something that interested me anyway, so I was interested in the course. And I guess he was my first exposure to a more conservative approach to the law. And I was kind of taken up with that. I mean, that intellectually was very interesting to me. Sort of, it was a new way of looking at the law that maybe I hadn't. I just thought, you got to be a lawyer and you went out and did justice and did good. And I didn't think about all these conservative principles, and he sort of awakened me to that. So they are two professors I very much remember and respected at the law school. I would say they were probably my two favorites. I had courses under Emerson and courses under Wellington, took labor law from Wellington, which was an interesting course, social policy, which was another thing that interested me a lot, so I enjoyed that class a lot. I took a philosophy course under Northrop. That was good. Whew, I took evidence. That was my worst course at the law school. I've never been good at evidence. Even when I was a judge, I just thought, oh, gosh, I'm going to have to make a call on this evidentiary issue. And I got to the point I decided that evidence was to help you get through a trial in a manageable fashion. And if you thought of it that way, you could make your rulings. Like, I don't think this is going to be helpful for you to go there, so let's stop right now. So once I started looking at it in that way, I became more comfortable in making evidentiary rulings. But when I was trying to think, you know, is this an exception to the hearsay rule, blah, blah, blah. This is a dying declaration. All these little rules you learn in evidence. Once I forgot about those and started thinking about the larger purpose of evidentiary rules, I got along a lot better with it. But I didn't like it very much in law school, I tell you that. I had Charlie Reich for constitutional law. I enjoyed his class. He's the guy that wrote The Greening of America and we became good friends. I stayed in touch with him for a while after law school when I was in Washington. I would see him from time to time. And my last year at the law school, Kingman Brewster was inaugurated as president of Yale. And Professor Reich invited me to go to the inaugural ball with him. But what I've always remembered about it, we went into the inaugural ball and they had a guy there who we gave our names to. And then he would shout out our names so everybody would know we had arrived. And then we would meet Kingman Brewster. Well, I gave him my name, which was Battle Rankin. And he shouted out, Miss Battlewagon. So that was one of my funny stories of my days at Yale, was being introduced to Kingman Brewster as Miss Battlewagon. And anyway, who else did I have? I think I said I had Emerson and Charles Black. I took a course under him. Goldstein and Katz, I took their course in criminal law. And Anna Freud was there. She taught a course in psychiatry and the law. I took that course, which has not been very helpful in my life in general. But it was an interesting experience, yeah.
I'm going to try to close. There's a little... Do you want to take a break?
Maybe we could take a break.
Sure. Okay. There's just a